So this morning, we continue with our exploration of the Linji Lu. Let me read just a short passage that we all know well by now. If people of our own time are not able to realize the fruits of the practice, why is that? It is because they do not have the virtue of self-confidence. Because you do not have the virtue of self-confidence, you are always preoccupied, in a hurry to run after myriad kinds of objects outside yourselves. And then you're turned around in circles by these objects and lose all your freedom. And then, moving on, my friends, as far as the insight of this mountain monk goes, there is no difference between you and Shakyamuni Buddha. Today, in every ordinary daily activity you do, do you feel you lack anything? Is there any moment when the six miraculous beams of light do not shine out? Anyone who has that insight will be a person who has nothing to do throughout his life. So, Linji tells us that we are always preoccupied, running after myriad kinds of objects outside of ourselves. They turn us around in circles. We lose all our freedom. And then he tells us again and again, the practitioner who does not have enough self-confidence will always direct his attention to what is external. Do not run after things outside of you. Do not direct your energy to chasing after something outside of yourself. People go in search of three bodies as absolute standards outside of themselves. I counted this morning, he tells us at least 8 times not to go searching for things outside of ourselves. And I don't get the impression that Lin Ji was a particularly chatty guy. He's trying to tell us something so important about being human. But if there's only one place where he points to why we may be so constantly absorbed in looking outside of ourselves. Today, in every ordinary daily activity you do, do you feel you lack anything? This morning, I would like us to explore this idea of lack, because that sense of lack is what fuels us to go running after so many things that we hope will make us feel whole and make us feel good. So, following Lin Ji's instructions, when I look at lack, the first place to look is within. What do we mean by lack? Lin Ji is not talking about the kind of lack that we mentioned in the Dharma Dialogue a few days ago, the real lack, people who do not have what they need to live, food, shelter, clothing, companionship. He's talking to monks who are in a fairly sheltered environment. They have enough to eat, they have a roof over their head, they have clothes. And here we are, mountain monks, sitting in the midst of abundance. We have this beautiful zendo. We have delicious food. We have heat. We have the Dharma. We have each other's companionship. We are in the midst of abundance. And yet, I sit on my cushion, feeling the lack, and finding myself falling into plots and plans and strategies to get what I feel I don't have. So, what does this lack look like as it arises in me? I notice that it's a feeling of not being enough, and that it's waiting to arise at any moment that it has the opportunity. It wants to land somewhere. So, I make the mistake of collecting the sutra books too early and need to be almost physically restrained. Ooh, lack. I don't say enough in the Dharma dialogue. Lack. I say too much in the Dharma dialogue. Lack. And it's not just the mind of right and wrong that I think is a lovely phrase, but carries a kind of neutral quality to it. This lack that Bob feels carries shame. A sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach. My face gets flushed. And this lack is just waiting to find a home, moment after moment. Lin Ji knew about this, and he was trying to tell his monks about it, and hoping that they would have self-confidence. So I investigate further, and I notice that there are moments when the lack is not there. When I'm bowing to the Buddha at the altar, when I'm bowing to one of you in the parlor as we talk about some arrangement for Sesshin, when I'm lighting a candle, when I'm ringing the wake-up bell, those moments when there is no separation between me and what I'm doing and who I'm with, sometimes it's the Dharmakaya, it's the oneness, the emptiness, just this. Sometimes it's the Sambhogakaya, sometimes it's watching the snowflakes. No Bob, just miraculously individual beautiful snowflakes falling. No lack. Sometimes it's scrubbing the toilet, sometimes it's scrubbing a pot. When we're just in it, the Nirmanakaya. And what I notice is that that dream of self, that person who is not enough, subsides. And in those moments, when we really see, when we really ask that question, who's hearing, who's taking the step in Kinhin, and there's nobody there, and then even the question falls away, then there's no lack, there's no separation. Lin Ji says to us, have self-confidence. That's what we need. And to play with his words, I've come to see, as I explore how lack arises and passes away in Bob, that really it's the moments where I have confidence in no self, that there's no lack. And there's no need to pursue anything, no strategy. And so I would urge us monks to be awake for those moments when we have no self-confidence. What about this lack that wants to attach anywhere and everywhere it can? Well, I came across a book recently by a Zen teacher and philosopher. His name is David Loy. Some of you may have read him. He writes a lot about politics and the environment. And he makes a link that I find so helpful. A link between lack arising for Bob on the cushion and so much of what we see in the world. He says that most of us, maybe all of us, not just Zen practitioners, but everybody, has an intuition that there is no fixed self, no entity, nobody home. And that that intuition is terrifying. And so we handle it in a variety of ways. Some of us come to the coming and going sesshin and we practice and we investigate this matter. But he says that some of us instead react to that terror by doing everything we can to try to make the self more real, this self that can't ever be made real. And so we move out into the world seeking for affirmation of a self that's important, that's immortal, that's just there. And he says that some of that may help us understand the pursuit of things that, on the surface of it, may seem a little crazy. So, the pursuit of wealth for its own sake. Not the pursuit of meeting one's material needs, but the pursuit of wealth because, as one of my wealthy patients said, the wealthier I am, the more of a player I am. Or the pursuit of fame. Think about all the people who want to become famous. I actually had reason to look at this. A recent survey said that, in fact, more than half of millennials said that one of their major life goals was to become famous. Why would we want to have many, many people who we've never met know our name and think about us? What? That's an odd preoccupation. Well, one idea would be that this is one way to say, yes, I'm real. All these people think about me. I'm a real self. And in thinking about this lack, I think this is what brought me started the seeds of what brought me to Zen. When I was a teenager, in my high school English class, we had to read English poetry. And teenage boys don't generally like English poetry. I didn't. But our teacher gave us a sonnet that became a kind of turning word for me that simply knocked me over. It's by the British poet Shelley. Some of you may know it. It's called Ozymandias. I'm going to read it. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear, my name is Ozymandias, king of kings, Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round all this decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. Suddenly, I was aroused out of my teenage self-absorption because here I was with so many other people I knew trying to be exceptional, trying to figure out what was my mark going to be in life. And here was this poet giving us this image of someone who was so certain that he had mastered everything. And there was this monument to him that would last forever. And there it was, shattered in the middle of empty sands. And then there is the contrast, the possibility that Linji holds out for us. Is there any moment when the six miraculous beams of light do not shine out? Anyone who has that insight will be a person who has nothing to do throughout his life. Ah, what a relief. No self to shore up. No empires to build. Just one foot in front of the other in the Kinhin line. A true person of no rank. So my lack continues to arise. I'll find a home for it probably within a few minutes. What then? Well, it's not to be banished. It doesn't work that way. As we know in our practice, everything invited in, nothing left out. What then might be the spiritual teaching in this lack? Well, it allows me certainly to have much more compassion for myself. And for those many, many hungry ghosts roaming around, trying to be good enough, trying to fill that void. And also, as I see the lack and I see through this dream of self, it leaves me, it leaves all of us, more open to seeing the real lack everywhere. Places where we can really be skillful in alleviating poverty, hunger, injustice, aching loneliness. And so, like everything on our path, my lack is a gift. How boundless and free is the sky of samadhi. How bright the full moon of wisdom. Truly, is anything missing now? Nirvana is right here, before our eyes. Thank you. So, sit. Sit any way you want. Let's have our Dharma dialogue. Yeah, Joyce.
There was nothing lacking in what you said.
Oh, thank you. Oh my gosh. Can I just record that and play it again a lot? Okay, good.
You know, I don't usually talk to these things. I've talked maybe once, but your voice was, I don't know, the whole thing just really touched me. So I am I've wrestled with this a lot because I've been at home with my kids for a while, feeling like I need to be someone. I need to be out there. And I guess, you know, the whole thing about going back into academia, I was a professor, and there is so much ego there. And, and the whole thing of having to make a name for yourself, and having to publish, and having to be someone. So, you know, I mean, it's like a factory of lacking.
Yeah, yes.
You know,
yes.
In ways. And, you know, so I don't know how I'm going to, if I go back into that environment, which may be possible, you know, it's one thing to be in the Zendo, we talk about this, but to be in an environment, you know, where you're supposed to make a name for yourself and you're supposed to be someone,
yeah.
It's kind of hard to bring it out into the world.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and I'm sure academia is not the only profession where it's the case, but, you know, I just really... Before I went into that the field, I just thought that it would be more about knowledge and about...
Yeah.
And I was surprised when I found it so much more about you have to do this, you have to make a name for yourself, you have to have a CV that's 20 pages long. You know, you have to be someone. So, anyway, those were my thoughts. Thank you. It was
Oh, Joyce, thank you so much. I mean, what you're describing has been one of the great koans of my life, because I'm also in that kind of environment in my work life. And it's, you know, how can, and for, I think the question is, how can we turn toward the things we love and the things we really value? And there are things you love and value, it sounds like, in your work. How can we turn toward those and be enough in that world that we can still continue to be able to do what we love without having to shore up some artificial sense of importance? And I sit in meetings, and now I sit in some ways with this eye about shoring up the self, and it really helps me. It's still, you know, but I find that when I bring that, I bring more compassion and less despair to it. Susan,
thank you for what you said. 50 years ago, I was right where you are now, and I didn't have any Zen Sangha. And my husband asked, what would I like for Christmas? And I said, I would like to have a uniform, a dress uniform, with a plastic pin that says, Mrs. McGraw. And then I would be an official person. I hope you're going to do a lot better than that. I think you will.
Well, and then could I just add that then you went on to become... not an academic, but a very powerful person in the world as a lawyer, you know, and I think what, you know, it's so wonderful that you brought this in, and, you know, I think stimulated by your talk, because I think your life has been about, and so actually so has Susan's, been about this koan, right, of who am I and how can I do what I love. And, you know, you're one of the most powerful academics in the New England area, but maybe in the world, I don't know.
I think the universe.
But it's awful when you're really good at what you do. That there is this tendency to think, I did this. I am wonderful. And then if you're doing that, the lack. just right comes up. But it's like the realm of the gods in academia, yeah. You know, in the realm of the gods in Buddhism, you get everything you want, yeah. But then you think, oh my God, what's going to happen when it gets snatched away from me?
Yeah.
So I just admire your ability, and I think Susan's too, and actually Joyce's too, to ride the waves of this. It's very hard. Some of us can do it. I gave up. I couldn't do it.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that I think we, you know, we're all grateful for this practice and this Sangha, but I think one of the things I notice more and more is the suffering that I see then when I go back. And of course, you know, in the grand scheme of things, the suffering of a few academics sounds pitiful, right? But it is suffering. It's real pain. And this lack is so painful. You know, and here it arises in all of us, and it doesn't matter how many accolades and how long the list of accomplishments is, it hurts. And this is the only place I've ever found to really investigate that.
Well, I think, too, when we turn toward the lack, there's, you know, this going and coming, we're never astray. Mm. So at home with children, out in the world giving lectures at conferences, there's some fundamental way that it's not different. So and Linji encourages mm-hmm. us to be the master of the situation we're in. And that doesn't mean, as a parent well knows, it doesn't mean you're controlling, you know, the kids, and you're not controlling the university. But there is a way of standing in our own shoes where we are, and keeping turning back to our own experience. Wow, this is what's happening right here. And so we practice that here on the cushion. We practice that at home with kids. We practice that. And so it's not about better to go out and make a name, you know, or go out and be in it and not get caught in it. I mean, that's fine to do. And also fine not to do. Mm-hmm. So I think as we look deeper, it's not a question of what we're doing. You're actually free. We're all free to do, to not do, to go, to retire, to come forward. All of that, never astray. So the question is not should we do this or that, but how to be present where we are. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. I just want to call out one more thing about what you said, Joyce. I love that phrase, the factory of lack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know, I think about Linji. So here's, he lived towards the end of the Tang Dynasty in China, which had, you know, also its own factory of lack in the whole Confucian system, which just got getting worse and worse over the centuries. And a lot of people were struggling with the same things we're struggling with around this. You got to make a name for yourself. You got to pass all these exams. You got to, you know, you got to be a minister. And I love the stories where ministers come to Linji or any of the other teachers, you know, and they're the people who are like us in a way. It's just seems human to create these factories of lack, just like everywhere, every in home life, in academic life, the legal system, being a minister. I mean, I'm just thinking about all of us in here who've tried so hard, and some of us just, I think that's the key, just acknowledging, I'm in the factory of lack.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's hopeless.
Yeah, Leah.
I think that my realization, and this just helps support the things that in my lifetime, what seems to be the space that brings me forward has emptiness in it. It's empty. And not empty like nothing happening, but empty like I don't know what's happening. And that there's space and there's light. And it's kind of antithetical to the world I live in, which says you gotta think, you gotta make plans, you gotta have something to say, you have something to produce, and so forth. And so there's this knowing that that's what's real and right for me, and at the same time, dealing with the fact that it isn't real and right for everybody else. So it looks like left and somebody looks at it. But, you know, it tried to be true to that.
And acknowledging that this doesn't, you know, that sense of what you need is different for you than it is for other people. I used to have this feeling of, why doesn't everybody do this practice, right? It's so amazing. And now I realize, no, that why, just like you, I find this need for spaciousness and that the practice provides, and that the turning toward everything provides, is something that other people just don't want. And so we operate together in a dance where we all show up in our different ways.
This place of lack for me shows up a lot around expectations. When I kind of like set in my mind something that I plan to be happening. Like yesterday, before I went on a walk, I was like, yeah, I'm gonna go on this nice walk, it's gonna be beautiful. And went, and everything was just gray and dead. And I'm walking, and I'm like, oh man, this is supposed to be a nice walk. And just kind of like wandering around and, you know, kind of enjoying, you know, that feeling of, I don't know, it not being beautiful and whatnot, and then came to like the back of the temple, and there's like this yellow bush out there that's like the only like yellow thing, only thing with like color that I think exists in this neighborhood still. But it was just like this really just like kind of like spark of something that like I was expecting, I guess, to see that beauty everywhere. But just got it in like that one spot. But yeah. Just these expectations that you just
towers. Yeah, I love that. I mean, both the, this isn't what I signed up for. This isn't the walk I signed up for. This isn't the weather I signed up for. It's supposed to be sunny, right? You know, and then, and you were just sort of enjoying that, I didn't want this, and then, and you were present for it, if you will. And then something new arrives. You know, this yellow, suddenly, whoa. Yeah. Steve.
So, I know what I lack. And it's a lottery ticket for tonight's lottery. It's supposed to be the largest lottery ever in the United States.
Really?
Yeah. But now we all feel lack. Now we all feel lack.
Yeah, exactly. I've spent my lack to everyone. But what I wanted to explore for just a moment was this whole idea of being able to look at a lack and dig into it, you know? So why do I buy a lottery ticket? And why do so many poor people buy lottery tickets, you know? So, and the whole idea of money, you know, and the need for money. Because guess what? You need money.
Yeah. Yeah.
We all need at some level. What do you do with it? And how do you do it? How do you deal with it? Because I've seen where money has done great good. And I've seen where money has done absolutely devastating. You know, like leavened. It's just like a sword, just leavened a person right down on the ground. Because they've taken that money and literally destroyed their lives with it. So I you know, there's this wonderful thing about lack, you know, that in a way we're talking about dukkha, but it's very plastic, you know. It's a very malleable thing. So, you know, maybe, you know, when we're looking at lack, maybe we're not looking at something that is necessarily bad.
What's the wonderful thing about lack?
There you go.
You said there is.
What is it?
What is it? You want to know?
We do. Play it on us, brother.
All right. I'd be a lazy lump. Absolute, like, worthless in some respects, all right? Incapable, okay? But there are lacks that drive me to do certain things that I need to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right? And so there's maybe lack with a little L, and maybe there's lack with a little L. Yeah. Okay? Yeah. And I just want to leave it that, Bob, because you're bouncing up and down.
Yeah, sorry.
It's this wonderful
stillness.
Lack.
Bob has a response.
So yeah. What struck me when you were speaking was this wonderful opportunity to look at this.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I want to buy a ticket, but why do I want to buy a ticket? Why do I want $1.3 billion?
Yes.
What the effing would I ever do with that kind of
right, right.
Okay. You're the Dow the Temple.
Yeah, 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 exactly. We would.
Don't you think I thought that?
So go buy that ticket. So
we're going to do Keenan down to the grave.
So, right. So lack with a little L, lack with a big L.
Right.
So let's say lack with a big L is the, if I got $1.3 billion, my life would be all good, right? That's the fantasy. And I can tell you from the other part of my life that, in fact, they've done research on this and shown that people who win the lottery actually return to their previous level of happiness within months. That's not it. Because money itself is empty.
Mm.
That, you know, many things you were motivated, you'd be a slug if you didn't have to feed your family, if you didn't have to put a roof over their head. Yeah, that's, you said, I want those things, and you went and got them. And those were things that mean something to you, right? They really do. But $1.3 billion is empty. And that's the, and yet, you know, with so many people out there, well, 80% of those millennials in that survey said that a major life goal was to get rich. So rich, not meet my material needs, rich. And so you're not alone in wanting that lottery ticket. I'll stop bouncing now.
It's a great result of bounce.
Yeah.
And I want to sort of go into this from another perspective, because I want to return to something Camden said that I think is connected to what you're saying. Of course, it's not about lack, I think. You're talking about desire, too, right? Isn't the other side of lack desire? I want this thing. I want to have more money. I want my family to be provided for. There's a wanting. There's a like a positive. You know, I notice something needs to happen here. And that's an intentional thing. I notice that my life isn't quite making sense to me. I've heard about this Zen stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go and study that. And at first, you know, it seems like that's going to solve all our problems and save us.
So you're saying that's not a lack?
Well, I'm just changing the vocabulary.
Ah.
I'm just saying that it's a desire. Right, that we have these desires. And when Camden went out, he had a very strong desire to have a beautiful experience.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever we have these desires, and there's some research on this as well, the narrower the desire, the less the chance there is that it will be fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
And the mind makes desires narrow. You know, so at the stress reduction clinic where I used to work, people would come in and say, in 8 weeks, I want my blood pressure to be lower. Right, very narrow. Turns out those people missed the other things that were happening to them, which is that they were getting happier, they had better relationships with their family, they were, other things were shifting and changing in their lives because they had been introduced to meditation practice. But their blood pressure maybe didn't go down. And so then they would say at the end, it was a failure, you know, it was a bad walk. It was ugly, right? I didn't get what I wanted. So part of this gesture that we learn here, we're all motivated for one. So somebody comes to that clinic wanting their blood pressure to be lower. Great motivation. At a certain point, when they don't need that motivation anymore, it drops away and something else arises. And I think that's it. So we could be walking through the dirty streets, you know, with the gray snow and the gray clouds, and suddenly we don't even have to see a yellow bush. We actually see the gray snow. Mm-hmm. It pops mm-hmm. out at us mm-hmm. as the thing itself. But if we're only looking for beauty, we miss it. We miss it. So this I, you know, did you pick the reading the temple, you know, I sit and meditate on emptiness. What's that?
I didn't. Oh, Steve picked it.
I love that. I was so happy when you went to that one. Because there's something in there that's very relevant to what we're studying.
Ship here. Of Compassion.
The Ship of Compassion.
Absolutely.
I don't even know what's going on. Another way to talk about that text is, I don't know why I'm here. But I get a little whiff sometimes of something. Mm. Like, that little whiff isn't... So any idea I have of awakening, Kensho, being a happy person, being a wise person, but this little whip, there's something here, I can't put my finger on it, but it's what I've really wanted, even though I thought what I wanted was this. And so I think that's enough.
Diane? How would you weigh in on this?
Just sitting here quietly looking at the sunlight.
All right.
Man. No lack there.
Wonderful.
So Abraham is thinking. So Ken?
Yeah, Abraham.
So I think there's a stance towards lack that could be really, I think some of the stances that we, one of the stances we've talked about could be really useful most of the time, but then I think in some cases it could get dangerous, so which is, the stance being, if there's lack, it's okay.
Right.
Because...
Yes.
I came from a high school that had, like, my junior year there were two suicides just because there was this culture. I mean, the lack was the culture of lack.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that's something. I think there are some things, some kinds of lack which just need to be addressed.
Oh. Yeah.
That's it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I just want to underscore that's right, that there are real lacks out there for what we need to live to be okay, and they're not just material, as you say, they're emotional. You know, that some of these environments that people are in are these factories of lack, where there's so much pressure and there's no sense of companionship or sangha. They're just being alone with pressure and the need to achieve. And so that's a place where, you know, we don't just say that's fine. You know, we don't just turn away from these real lacks. I think what we're talking about is the situation where you say, well, my blood pressure didn't go up, but I'm sitting in the midst of abundance. My relationships are better. The sunlight's here. That's the lack we're talking about, the failure to recognize abundance everywhere.
Such a sad situation. I mean, you know it because you were in it, but I've just read about it, these environments that so many young people find themselves in, and you know, where all the emphasis is on becoming something, you know, something that you don't know how to do it, you know, and it's just this constant pressure cooker factory of lack, and the social media environment that you young people are much more in touch with than I am, and that seems like a huge factory of lack. And to be able to turn into that, to notice the feelings that arise in you, your reaction to it, is so important, because so easy to be blinded by this quest for fame, quest for wealth, just this getting caught up in all of that and feeling the loneliness it creates and the pain it creates, and so hard to actually turn toward that, but it seems to be the only thing to do. So, thank you.
And I think what I'm caught by too is that to realize that some of this lack is amplified by our culture and intentionally, I mean, like Joyce was saying, and like our educational system, there's some way that it's geared and advertising. Mm. There's something that is systemic about this that is not personal. So personally, I feel, well, just the problem is there's something wrong with me. You know, and when 99% of the people in an institution feel there's something wrong with me, it's not actually personal. And so even to talk about it and acknowledge it, because there's a taboo, not only are you lacking, you better not talk about how you're lacking, because that's the real thing. You've got to just achieve, you know, suck it up. And so I think looking both at, yeah, there are times we really need to act, and then looking at how the social structures, how it's woven in to our economic system, to, you know, this is a huge thing that we're dealing with here. And I think that the social change has to start internally when one person, as Diane was saying, is willing to feel, oh my God, I feel like I am nothing, like I will never be anything. And it comes out of the darkness. And we can say, and I think it's one of the things here, like when someone comes forward and say, you know, I'm losing it here. This is terrible. I want to go home. Like, then we can all go, oh yeah, I'm not the only one. Yeah. And I think there's something about not being the only one, right? That going back to the dukkha. So this lack, this is not a problem in some way. This is just what human beings feel, and an opportunity. But none of us can bear it alone. When it's my lack, and this is what is uniquely wrong with me, it's crushing. But when we say, "Oh, you too," you know, "Oh, we're in the we call it the nose hole society, human beings." Right. Oh, this is our passport. We all meet this lack. We all are engaged by it. It disturbs us. It drives us into awakening. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
All right.
Should we come? Oh, I get to say. Yeah. Maybe one more. Go ahead.
Mary. I'm remembering my years ago, my years as a high school debater, really in the middle of manufacturing lack. And I mean, your job is to project your lack onto the other team. And
yes.
Your argument is worse than mine.
Yes.
And I'm, you know, there were rounds of that I look back and saw that I was suffering, and I was in the middle of such misery, and I was just trying to shuck it off as best I could. But there were other times. There were one or two times during those years when, right in the middle of this stupid activity of trying to show somebody else was worse than you were, it just fell away. It no longer mattered whether I ended up winning that round, whether the judge was going to vote for me, but the zero-sum competition somehow became a cooperative venture between myself, my partner, and the two guys on the other team, to create a product within the time limits of what was allowed. We worked together to create this back and forth thing that didn't happen very often, but every once in a while there was this sense of flow in the middle of this factory line on the assembly line on the factory of black.
Yeah.
We just hit that. It came up sometimes.
That's beautiful.
Yeah,
we've been talking about the transcendence coming toward us.
Yeah.
So
beautiful opening.
That will go back to our cooperative venture.
Thank you.